You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. I'm Ted Kravitz. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, the day's events recapped and unravelled with Kathleen Burke and James Boyes. Today,
the lack of representation in the government, city council and police chiefs and firemen and fire chiefs, the whole range of inequality that leads to injustice and leads to alienation. The community must grow together. We've learned to survive apart. We must now learn to live together.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking earlier ahead of the funeral of Michael Brown. We'll be discussing the latest from Missouri. We'll be asking what's next for France's government and be assessing what US Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel might have planned in the offensive against the Islamic State. We'll also ask how a British nurse who's contracted the Ebola virus came to be airlifted from Sierra Leone to a North London hospital. And also coming up,
I like to use materials in a very industrial way and knowing the way it has been used in history, but altering the process to get the results which I am looking for.
Artist Javier Mascaro talks from his studio in Madrid ahead of the opening of his Guardians exhibition in London's Saatchi Gallery. All that, plus we're live to our correspondent in Mali. We'll sample the art events of the summer across Italy and play a little of the best music from Monocle's international playlist. That's all on Midori House, live from London, here on Monocle 24. So plenty to come, but first here's Bill Bingham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. The Ukrainian military is reported to be fighting rebel armoured vehicles from Russia on their way to the southeastern city of Mariupol. Military sources say the column was halted near the town of Novoazovsk. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says he hasn't heard the reports, but he's complained of what he calls regular disinformation about their so-called incursions. Mr. Lavrov says Russia also plans to send another humanitarian convoy into eastern Ukraine in the next few days, as the humanitarian situation there is deteriorating. At least 9 people have been killed in a suicide bomb attack on a Shia mosque in Baghdad. Iraqi officials say the attacker detonated his explosive vest during noon prayers at the southeastern area of New Baghdad. Sectarian tensions in Iraq have been heightened by the seizure of large swathes of the country by Islamic State militants and allied Sunni rebels. United Nations Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay has condemned what she calls the appalling widespread crimes being committed by Islamic State forces in Iraq. Human Rights Office spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says the High Commissioner believes Islamic State is guilty of ethnic and religious cleansing.
Such cold-blooded, systematic and intentional killing of civilians after singling them out for their religious affiliation may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The High Commissioner is also calling on the international community to ensure that perpetrators of these vicious crimes do not enjoy impunity. Any individual committing or assisting in the commission of international crimes must be held accountable.
The Israeli military has carried out a new round of airstrikes in Gaza as Palestinian militants continue to fire rockets and mortars into Israel. Meanwhile, efforts have been stepped up to end the 6 weeks of fighting that have left more than 2,000 people dead. Hundreds of mourners are attending the funeral for the black teenager killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. 18-year-old Michael Brown, who was unarmed, was killed on the 9th of August after being stopped by a white police officer for walking in the middle of the street. His death sparked days of protests and violent clashes, but tensions appear to have eased in recent days. Long queues of mourners have entered the friendly Temple Baptist Church, where today's service is being held. The teenager's father, Michael Brown Sr., has appealed for calm.
All I want is peace, but my son's being laid to rest. You please, please, take a day of silence so we can lay our son to rest. Please, that's all I ask.
A lockdown at an army base in Virginia following a shooting incident has been lifted. Army officials say the lockdown was prompted by a female soldier who turned the gun on herself. According to an army press release, the unnamed suspect fired one shot, wounding herself at Fort Lee Army Base in central Virginia. No one else was injured. French President François Hollande has told his Prime Minister Manuel Valls to form a new government after two senior ministers criticised their austerity policies. After Monsieur Valls announced the cabinet's resignation, Monsieur Hollande immediately asked him to set up a new one. Economy Minister Arnaud Montebourg and Education Minister Benoît Hamon are expected to lose their jobs. They both called for France to tackle low growth by resisting fiscal discipline imposed by Germany. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Bill. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this with the day's wrap.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, de London, this is Monocle 24.
Oplondo, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, 6 minutes past the hour. Now, we are joined in the studio with their take on the day's news by Cathy Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and James Boyes, political historian, academic and writer. Welcome both to the programme, and thank you for battling your way, presumably armed with umbrella, through this pretty much intense day of rain we've had in London. Who says it's late August?
It's a bank holiday, what do you expect? And it's Notting Hill Carnival Day. Of course it's going to rain.
Indeed so. Okay, well, thank you anyway, because I know it's been pretty unrelenting out there. But first, to international security and to the US, where Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has warned of the threat to America posed by the Islamic State group, describing it as an imminent threat to every interest we have. Now, this was in a briefing given, I think, over the weekend, together with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, who himself, I think, is off to Afghanistan now, if I'm not wrong on that one. What are we to make of this? Was this a sort of direct reaction from the Foley death, or has this been coming for a while? Cathy, first.
This has been coming for a while. I mean, it's been creeping, because the Obama administration, of course, is dead keen not to have mission creep. But mission creep is taking place in the corridors, I think. And but Foley made it. The death of Foley by a British jihadist made it imperative that the Americans do something. They made it imperative, or made it possible, in fact, that the Obama administration could actually say they're going to go out and fight if necessary. So the background was there, but the foreground is because of Foley, I think.
James, how are we to interpret that message? Are they all singing from the same hymn sheet here, Hagel and Obama?
It's difficult to tell at the moment. There really hasn't been any sort of firm sense of direction set by the president. But to be frank, it's not helped by the fact that this is occurring during silly season when leaders around the world, be it David Cameron or Barack Obama, are on their holidays. I think one of the challenges we face here, though, as citizens, is this idea that, you know, we talk about mission creep, but there's also a degree of mission fatigue. How many times over the last 10 years have we heard from one set of politicians or another, oh, this terrorist threat is the greatest threat we've faced, yada, yada, yada. You know, I think back to seeing Dick Cheney, for example, on Meet the Press talking about underground caves and lairs and describing Al-Qaeda like it was Spectre from an early James Bond film of some sort. There's no doubt that ISIS is an existential threat and a physical threat to many interests around the world. But I think we need to recognise the fact that it's also in the military's self-interest to build up the threat, because that will, of course, help build up the defence budget.
Except, of course, that it's been made clear that Obama has made it clear that there aren't going to be boots, or in this case, sandals on the ground, as it were. But it's also been made clear that the CIA and probably special forces will go out.
Which is the same message we've had from other governments, isn't it?
Including the British government.
Already there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've been in a number of discussions and debates about this, and about, you know, should we get involved? It's like, we are involved. Yeah. There are military forces in place. The British have got support aircraft. They've got surveillance aircraft. As Cathy rightly points out, there's guaranteed presence of special forces on the ground. The troubling thing at this point is it's ISIS who's setting the agenda. You know, they're the ones who are talking about not recognising borders. We're having to play catch up and say, well, yeah, us too. And this big thing about should we ally with Syria, should we ally with the devil? We've done it before. We did it with Russia. The question here is, what's most important, maintaining a moral high ground or winning the battle?
And there's a key missing, if I may just say, which is Turkey. I mean, the Turkish border is the border over which the jihadists are coming, where they can sell the oil, where they can get their supplies. And until that's closed, because, of course, ISIS is shooting up north right now, trying to control that border, until the Turkish government moves troops there to try to close the border, there's absolutely nothing permanent that anyone can do.
Well, it's a good point. And as General Martin Dempsey says himself, he, of course, puts the Syria point on the table, as it's impossible to defeat the IS completely without going after them in Syria.
Yeah,
that's another hole. That's another hole.
It is, because, again, you're talking here about respecting international borders or not. We're talking about potentially allying with Assad, who, you know, only a couple months ago we were talking about bombing. So Malcolm Rifkin here in the UK has basically said it's something we might have to, unpalatable though it is, actually get involved with. The problem you've got at the moment is that Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes admitted last week that there are no other options on the table at the moment for the American administration. And that's quite concerning, if indeed it's true.
What long-term strategies are actually on the table here? Do we know? Do we have an idea?
Well, the long-term strategy is that all Western democratic countries are going to be at war with ISIS until, I don't know, the 2030, 2040, 2050. They're all saying it's going to take years and years and years. And the problem is that even if you control the countryside against ISIS, which is unlikely, they're controlling cities as long as civilized responses is not to go bomb the hell out of civilians.
Do we even know who the enemy is? I mean, we're seeing as we head, you know, a British man.
This is true. This is true. I mean, I was saying last week, I thought it was a massive tactical mistake to make it so openly obvious that it was a Brit and that there would be, you know, forces within MI6 basically looking at voice recognition and going after him. The suggestion is they already know who he is and, you know, woe betide him when they find him. But you were asking about a long-term plan. There's no long-term plan because, of course, the Obama administration's out of office in 2 years' time. So, you know, whatever Hillary decides to do next will be interesting.
Yep, good point. Okay, let's move on. 12 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House. To France next, where the Prime Minister Manuel Valls dissolved his government over the weekend after the left-wing faction headed by Economy Minister Arnaud Montebourg broke ranks and called for an end to austerity policies directed by Germany. Now, Cathy, this is all good fun, isn't it? Because it's quite amusing to watch sort of French politicians from the left having a go at the German right. But this is pretty much an unprecedented event in French history, isn't it? Or at least recent French government history.
Well, remember the Fourth Republic, which was called the revolving door government because they went in and out, you know, not precisely on a weekly basis. Mitterrand is what brought them under control, in fact. But yes, they are very split. They're split between those who think they can win an election by being moderate and those who think that life is too short to betray what are the proper God-given ideas that you know, in terms of the left wing. This has been coming. It's been coming. There have been hits at it over the past, 6 months, I suppose. Indeed, as of right now, of course, Montebourg and Hamon, the economic and education ministers, are gone. Philippe Petit, the cultural minister, justice minister, has gone. And we have another one waiting for. And the real problem here is the split is so that the fear is that Hollande is going to lose control of the assembly. And if he then loses control and he's defeated and he has to go for an election, it's pretty probable that the socialists will lose. So there's a certain self-inflicted wound by the left right now.
Especially difficult for Hollande because his popularity is as low as it's ever been. And actually, what Montebourg might be calling for is actually quite a popular view.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we've talked in the past on this show about Obama's popularity. Quite frankly, I think Hollande must be praying for Obama's opinion poll ratings. I believe Hollande is somewhere hovering around 17% at this point. If there was an election anytime soon, heaven help him. But I think a lot of this is with an eye to the next presidential election in 2017, for example. So you've got Montebourg Luxembourg looking at that. The current prime minister is clearly looking at that, looking ahead and thinking, how am I going to position myself here? We're seeing, a repeat, arguably, of the debate about austerity measures, which have been playing out not only in Europe, but around the world over the last couple of years, the classic left-right split about whether to spend or save your way out of austerity. And clearly the French left don't like the idea that at the moment, they're using an austerity measure, which is associated with sort of more right-wing politics to get in there, especially the fact that it's being driven, in their view, I'd say unrealistically, by Merkel.
There's a more fundamental point at break here that we should probably keep in mind. Ever since the Second World War, it has been the drive by both the British and the French to be together. That is to say, if they work together, if they have some sort of a tacit alliance, Europe will not blow up again. And what we are seeing here for the first time in two generations is an actual open split between the two in a way that, in fact, they're being quite nasty. Well, the French are being quite nasty about Angela Merkel, which isn't going to help them at all. But nevertheless, looking over the medium term, it is very interesting that France and Germany are going in different directions right now. And this is and what will be interesting if the right gets back in, if this will still be the case, or French national ideas remain in control.
Interesting also from a political level as to how these ministers within Manuel Valls' government were seem able and let themselves actually talk like this, perhaps questioning his authority, even though the Prime Minister has been quite quick to try and assert his authority back on them. But he felt that perhaps his authority wasn't particularly strong in the first place, mm-hmm. if they felt they could speak out like this. And not just one of them, a few, as we said.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think what it does is it puts quite into interesting perspective how successful, in many ways, David Cameron and Nick Clegg have been at holding this coalition together in the United Kingdom. I mean, I think one of the benefits of that deal was the idea that they would go for a set government. I think there's far too little praise been given to that. I think the idea that you've got collective governmental responsibility, the fact that he talked out of line before he did this, what he should have done, of course, was resign and then give this speech, quite frankly. It's good that he's done that. He's called this absurd, inefficient and unfair. And, hats off to him for coming out and saying that. But I think there was a procedure that he missed in doing so.
There is that by being dismissed, he can mobilize. Because the argument could be if he had resigned, that meant he was getting out of taking responsibilities.
Okay, we're expecting Montebourg to deliver a speech later today, but it's going to be interesting, isn't it? Ahead of the, I think it's 2017 next presidential election, Sarkozy coming back.
Absolutely, it's a distinct possibility. So we're talking about the left being fractured, but of course there's going to be all sorts of ruptures on the right as well. What's Sarkozy going to do? The expectation is that he'll throw his relatively short hat into the ring, and we'll see where that leads. But it'll be an interesting return to the stage, I think.
Especially since his prime minister, Fillon, has always also made it clear that he's going to throw his hat into the ring. Mm. Oh, I love it. We're going to have ructions on the right as well.
Yeah. All good fun, as I said in the introduction. Okay, a few more topics to deal with. You're listening to Midori House here with Kathy Burke and James Boyes. Coming up, we'll be discussing how likely we are to see reform in US police forces post-Ferguson, and we'll be looking at the UK's Ebola patient evacuation.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
Just approaching 20 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Kathy Burke and James Boyes. Now to go to Missouri, shall we? Where at the Friendly Temple Baptist Church, the funeral of Michael Brown is being held. In fact, I think it's just finished. His family have appealed for calm on the streets this evening, and certainly residents of Ferguson and the surrounding areas are hoping they can start getting their lives back to some kind of normality. But what's changed? Has anything been achieved? As peace seems to be on the streets, Kathy, recently, do we detect any change in police force and the ways they govern?
Well, a number of them are talking the talk. Of course, what we don't know is if they're actually going to walk the walk. Mm. I think the militarization, the pictures on television of tanks, you know, and riot gear and assault rifles really shocked an awful lot of people. It's also made St. Louis Dispatch, I think, newspaper, look around at what the ratio of blacks to black police officers were in all the towns around, and I think people were startled. There's only one, I think, a University City department that has roughly the same percentage of blacks and percentage of black police officers. But I think something will be done. I think something will be done in this case because it was just so appalling nationally as well as locally that too many people have said now that things have to change, and police departments have said they're going to try to do their best to increase. But as they said, if they don't apply, we can't hire them.
Yes, that's a crucial point, isn't it? I mean, we'll get to the militarization of the police just in a moment, but your thoughts on that, the lack of diversification in US police forces across the country, James?
It's difficult to tell, isn't it? Because, of course, nationally, the African-American community is about 13-14% tops. Now it's going to have massive regional differences. The question is do you want, or should you even, have a police makeup that directly reflects the local community? It's not always been done. In fact, I doubt it's ever been committed anywhere. You know, if you start looking at any organization, be it a police community, be it a chamber of government, you never really see at all a correct reflection of society within that. So I can't see that's going to change much. And I really can't see, to be honest, any move away from this militarization of the American police force. If anything, I'd say you're going to go the exact opposite, and you'll see it increasing just because of the ties between the American police force, the Pentagon, and the increasing sense of a nation under siege. And they'll bring ISIS into this, and they'll talk about we need greater forces to protect American citizens from the threats overseas and the permeation of the American border through the South, because it's all about expenditure and increasing spending upon military budgets.
Kathy, they have the SWAT teams have the equipment. Are they just going to park them out in a parking lot and not use them?
Well, one problem, of course, is that apparently the police forces aren't trained to use them.
Absolutely.
So the question is, even if you have them and if you're being safe, you're being dangerous because you don't know what to do with them. Mm. I mean, I agree with James, but the administration has said today, or perhaps it was yesterday, time is a continuum, that they're going to look at changing the process and changing the policy of Defense Department not only dumping their year old military equipment on police forces, but as James said, an awful lot of defense companies, because they can't sell to the government anymore, are quite happy to sell them to police forces. I do think that the images on television were so arresting that something I suspect will be done, even if it's only to train them to use the damnable things.
Okay, and just briefly on this topic, do we know what's being done on a government level? Is there anything been done against a sort of apparent systemic police racism?
Well, I don't know. I mean, at the moment we're talking about an incident that happened barely 2 weeks ago. So, you know, you'll appreciate the fact that government wheels of motion, especially when the government is on vacation, really isn't going to happen anytime soon. The Attorney General has gone down there. Remarkably, the White House has sent three emissaries to the funeral to join the likes of Spike Lee, for example, Al Sharpton. This whole thing has become a real-life bonfire of the vanities that I think far too many people are using for their own political ends. And one just hopes that there was room for the family at the funeral, quite frankly, because there were so many people there, I think, freeloading and using it for their own ends.
But I think we ought to recognize that there are some police forces, such as New York City, which have very strong, very successful diversity policies. Mm-hmm. I think, in a sense, one might say that the big urban police forces are probably a bit more successful at this. than the suburban and the local ones.
That's certainly true, but we've had incidents in the past about the idea that, you know, there was a Springsteen song that came out 10 or so years ago, 49 Shots, about the fact that you'd got ethnic kids being shot within the NYPD. So I'm not sure that a racial diversity necessarily results in the sort of ethnic lack of clashes or the death of young African Americans that one might hope it would do.
Well, we'll be returning to the US in just a moment, but to North London next. We're at the Royal Free Hospital in Hampstead, probably no more than 3 miles from where we're sitting. William Pooley, a nurse who had been helping victims of the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone before contracting, unfortunately, the virus himself, is recuperating in an isolation unit. He was flown back to the UK by the Royal Air Force, who sent a Boeing C-17 Globemaster to Africa to pick him up, which is more normally used to transport tanks, armoured personnel, or for parachuting aid packages. Are we surprised at this? The RAF tends not to send medevac aircraft like a C-17 to anything else. But this is a world health outbreak that's really caught the attention. But who would have paid, I suppose? Your UK government have an RAF C-17 flown out there and back? What do we think?
Well, I suspect that, well, the RAF paid, but probably with tacit agreement that they would get it made up. I don't think it's such a bad thing myself. I'm sorry that they couldn't bring back others as well, but if this is the only British one. I mean, what are they going to do? Send a helicopter across the Bay of Biscay and down the African coast? I don't see the problem, I must confess. I don't see why this is particularly an issue. I know this outside it is, that in the Americans there have been some comment on it. But I just think it's rather a good thing it happened. It shows the government cares. And there's always so much complaint that somehow the foreign office diplomats, the consuls don't take care of people. This, I think, is a good image.
I think the RAF should be, or indeed other air forces, be airlifting other serious medical cases home, James?
It is interesting, I don't know. I think, again, not for the first time, or I dare say the last time, the British government is following the American lead. We've had the incidents in the last week or two where the American individuals have been returned home from the African continent to places like Atlanta, for example, where the CDC has managed to treat them. And we've had this great story about someone who appears to have been cured of this horrendous disease. So if we can see people being returned home to the United States and Great Britain and surviving as a result of that evac, I think that's one thing. But we have to be so careful that these individuals are returned under quarantine conditions. And, you know, heaven help us if we do the right thing by bringing these nationals back to try and look after them, and then, you know, the disease spreads and you have some sort of an outbreak, you know, the idea of the road to hell being paved with good intentions, you know, looms large, I think.
Well, but the alternative, of course, is letting them die out in African villages, which is not necessarily something one would want to see. And I don't think Britain is following the American lead in this. I mean, the point is, it was a British citizen, and therefore I must confess I dislike the idea that somehow the government has to wait until the Americans lead the way with a plane.
Yeah, I suppose they needed a C-17 to keep the isolation of the patient intact.
Of course they're going to be isolated.
Indeed, yes. So there's some images of actually the ward in the Royal Free Hospital where this nurse, William Pooley, is being held. But how do you think it will impact other nations with aid workers at all? If at all?
Well, it depends very much. I mean, one of the benefits we have as citizens of the United Kingdom, the United States, is, you know, we do have governments which have the resources at hand to be able to do this. We can rely upon the United States Air Force and the Royal Air Force to medevac our citizens. Not every country necessarily has that facility. Not every country will have a government which, as Kathy rightly points out, cares so much about its citizens that it's prepared to invest time and money and energy to do that. One would hope that in all cases this would occur, but I think in all too many occasions their citizens will be left to die, as Kathy rightly points out, on the African plain.
Okay, we are heading to the bottom of the hour, so finally in this section, back to the US as promised, and the chair of the Fed, the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, who's come out with some revolutionary thinking, it's said, in terms of the jobs market and wages particularly. Now, Kathy, this was at Jackson Hole, was it not? A speech in Jackson Hole with a meeting with a fellow heads of central banks?
That's what Jackson Hole is about. I mean, they'd gotten in a habit of letting a lot of contingent investors investment bankers there as well, but it's now been pulled back to what it was supposed to be. The point is, she's a labor economist, not a monetarist, and she has brought back into the discussion the question of employment, wage rates, the percentage that actually working class, shall we say, middle class people get, whether it goes towards them or towards capital. But I think it's not that straightforward. The main issue was, are interest rates going to go up? Are interest rates going to go down? And she played a very good hand, because no one can decide whether they are or not. What does seem to be the case is that so-called quantitative easing is going to end in July, which means that a lot of created cash is no longer going to go into the economy. And I suspect in about a month, so let's say not July, but I can imagine in a couple of months' time we'll be discussing. Our Far Eastern economy is crashing because the Americans have stopped quantitative easing.
And James, I mean, as far as interest rates goes down, finally, then they can't go down any much more. So it's really a matter of time before they go up, and then by how much, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody who's got a mortgage at this point must be dreading the day when that eventually happens. I mean, it's often been said that economists were put on this earth to make astrologers look accurate. But this idea that the problem we have at the moment is that, you know, the best financial figures in the world, and they are pretty good coming out of the United States, just aren't translating into a feel-good factor effectively. That's very much the responsibility of leadership and rhetoric. It's fascinating to see how Janet Yellen is trying to sort of come into the Obama administration following Ben Bernanke and very much take a different lead on this, talking about potential rises in wages, which of course is something which economists for decades now have feared because of the inherent connection with a rise in interest rates.
But feel-good factors are not Janet Yellen's responsibility. That's a political responsibility. And the thing is, what we don't want and what central bankers are not supposed to be is at the behest of governments. So one may not agree with what she has or what she doesn't have, but one really doesn't want her to be a politico.
Well, all interesting stuff, but the time has beaten us. Clock has beaten us once again, so we'll have to leave it there. But for now, Kathy Burke and James Boyce, thanks so much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our correspondent in Mali and taking an exclusive visit to Javier Mascaro's workshop in Madrid. But before we get started on that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest world news headlines.
The Ukrainian military is reported to be fighting rebel armoured vehicles from Russia on their way to the southeastern city of Mariupol. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia plans to send another humanitarian convoy into eastern Ukraine in the next few days. At least 9 people have been killed in a suicide bomb attack on a Shia mosque in Baghdad. Iraqi officials say the attacker detonated his explosive vest during noon prayers in the southeastern area of New Baghdad. Hundreds of mourners have attended the funeral for the black teenager killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. 18-year-old Michael Brown, who was unarmed, was killed on the 9th of August after being stopped by a white police officer for walking in the middle of the street. A lockdown at an army base in Virginia following a shooting incident has been lifted. Army officials say the lockdown was prompted by a female soldier who turned the gun on herself at Fort Lee Army Base in central Virginia. French President François Hollande has told his Prime Minister Manuel Valls to form a new government after 2 senior ministers criticised their austerity policies. After Mr. Valls announced the cabinet's resignation, Monsieur Hollande immediately asked him to set up a new one. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much. Just coming up to 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Ted Kravitz. Now, a lot of heavy lifting is currently going on inside London's Saatchi Gallery as Spanish artist Javier Mascaró moves his massive metallic sculptures into place in preparation for an early September opening. This will be the first time Mascaró has shown in the UK, but before his 9.5-foot-tall Guardian Knights leave Londoners awestruck, our correspondent Liam Aldous visited the artist at his warehouse-sized studio on the outskirts of Madrid to talk about his work and the imminent opening of his Departures exhibition.
I've always been dividing my time between two or more studios because I like that the fact that you travel is inspiring, and also the fact that you are in different scenes, art scenes, cultural scenes. So for many years I had a studio in New York for 15 years, and in Madrid I've had it for 17 or 18 years now. And at this time I have my main studio in Madrid and one studio in Mexico City. And I spend more or less half time in each of the studios, depending on my schedules. This is a studio in Madrid. Is a very industrial space. I like it because of the scale. I can have together pieces which are really big, like the boat is 18 meters long, 12 tons, and also pieces which are a few grams and tiny. And it's a place where I do a lot of experimentation with materials, and I can, because of the size of the studio, have different scenographies with many different types of work. I like to work actually in different scales, and it's not so much about the size of the piece. Obviously it has to do with the size, because when you have a sculptor, you have a physical presence, and it's not the same to relate to something that overwhelms you, that's something which is small. But the biggest difference has to do with the attitude you approach the viewer. The viewer, to see something small, needs to get close, and it's a little bit as if you were whispering to the viewer, while when it's a large piece you are speaking loud voice. It's a difference like that. This piece is composed, it's made of the shackles of a couple, like each one of the members of the couple is a prisoner in this relationship, although they would fall apart if they were not leaning one on the other. That's the idea of this sculpture.
It's a little bit morbid, isn't it?
I wasn't feeling so well. I was actually getting divorced in that period of time. Although that was a great relationship, which is, I still keep in a very good terms with my ex-wife, but the way I was feeling was, I guess, like this, like a prisoner in a relationship. I'm very interested in many subjects, but the subject of the couple, I'm very interested because it's a basic piece in society and through history. So you see representations of couples in Egypt, which depict power, and others in other moments, the Kiss by Rodin, in which it represents love. But it has a lot to do with successfully developing society. At the Saatchi Gallery, in one of the galleries, there will be this semicircle of showcases containing masks. So I made this part will be in one of the galleries in one end, and in the other end there will be a representation of five iron heads, which I will show you downstairs, and a couple more pieces. And then the other gallery will be filled with an installation that consists in 25 iron and bronze boats. I like to use materials in a very industrial way, and knowing the way it has been used in history, but altering the process to get the results which I am looking for, which are full of accidents and like as if the result of time had been a partial destruction of the work, but it's a part of the process. This part of the installation is the what would be displayed outside the gallery, in just by the entrance, and it would be a line of five large guardians, 3 meters tall. which I had already shown previously in a larger group, first at the Palais Royal in Paris, and then at the Paseo del Prado in Madrid, and in some other museums and places. I love to have the opportunity to show, as I said, large scale with small scale, indoor and outdoor, because it's a different way to connect and communicate to the viewer. They are different. This is more about strength, and some others are more delicate and more about, as I said, loss, presence, other kinds of feelings. The reason why I cast these large guardians was that I wanted to experience, to feel what was it to have them by my side, to walk through them, and well, not through them, but between them, and feel the what I had the intuition that this piece would be powerful, but also serene, and I wanted to experience it. The thing with sculpture is it's not only an image or a meaning, it's also a physical presence that you relate to. And obviously the scale has it's significant, because when a piece overwhelms you, you can feel either disturbed or peace, as in this case, which I like.
That was Javier Mascaro talking to Monocle's Liam Aldous, and Mascaro's Departures exhibition starts at the beginning of September at the UK's, London's indeed, Saatchi Gallery. You're listening to Midori House.
A nation defining its identity or architectural vandalism, Monocle Films heads to the capital of the Republic of Macedonia to investigate a controversial building project.
Museums, theatres and government ministries have sprouted up along the riverbank, and with their neoclassical and Baroque stylings, the Skopje 2014 building boom harks back to the past. It's nothing less than eyebrow-raising, and for some, it's positively stomach-churning.
Skopje 2014, an architectural facelift, now playing in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:41 in Moscow, 18:41 here in London, 14:41 in Sao Paulo. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we're heading to Mali. Alex Duval-Smith joins us from Bamako now. Alex, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Now, let's go for our first topic to the subject of illegal migrants. And Mali has called for more international help to stem the flow of illegal migrants across the Mediterranean. You've been to see the Minister for Overseas Malians. What did he have to say?
Well, yes, there's been quite a lot of illegal immigrants, as they're known, in the news in the last few weeks. 100,000 people are believed to have lost their lives attempting to cross the Mediterranean in the last 3 years. And I went to see the minister, as you say, for Overseas Malians, Abdourahmane Sylla. Essentially, what came to light when I was having a conversation with him, because I'd heard about a report of 87 Malians dying in one single boat that went down a couple of weeks ago. He had more information on that, and it was the first time I actually heard details of what goes on between the traffickers. And this particular boat had left from Libya and had sunk. Apparently the trip across to Lampedusa only takes 6 hours, but the boats, the very scanty rafts that are used by the traffickers, sometimes spend up to a week, either because they're drifting or because they're waiting for a passage through the coast guards. So this boat had taken up to a week, and what happens in that time is that people get hungry and thirsty, they start drinking seawater, they get diarrhea and they die, and they're thrown overboard by the other people on board. The other thing he raised, which was quite shocking and which I think we're going to hear more about, is that people in Mali especially are beginning to send children across, because taking advantage of European legislation, that doesn't permit European countries to send minors back. So what happens is people just cast their 12 and 14 year olds loose to send them to an expected better future in Europe. And he had attempted to get to know one of these children and found this completely traumatized Malian 12 year old in an Italian hospital, unwilling to utter a word for 3 days, until finally a Malian woman was taken to his bedside and managed to convince him to speak again. So these traumatic stories, and of course, you know, people are arriving in Europe if they get in a state of complete trauma.
Mm. Yes, horrendous stories, and high death rates, as you say, on these crossings. Is there anything that Mali can do to dissuade, or is it more of the European countries can do to dissuade the migrants?
Well, Minister Silla says that he really doesn't have the means to do very much against what has become a cultural phenomenon here. And among the Solenke in western Mali, it's almost considered to be a failure if your eldest son hasn't left for pastures new. They call them the adventurers. So if you are the only sort of young man left in your village who hasn't attempted to travel, then you are not considered to be a good young man. And so there's that the Malian government can work on, the cultural side of things. But essentially, he says, you know, we just need more help to develop Mali so that there are opportunities, so it's actually worth staying on in the country.
Okay, let's move on to another topic. And this month marks a year since President Keita was elected by a landslide, indeed, to take control of Mali. What's his popularity figures like now? How is his popularity looking at the moment?
Well, he's still pretty popular in southern Mali, which is where I live, less so in northern Mali, where there's still a very serious security problem. And people feel the slowness much more acutely. That is, really, people are still worried about going outside the door, even though the presence of UN peacekeepers and French special forces does help from time to time. But really, unless you're in Timbuktu or Gao, unless you're in those two cities, it's a very dangerous place, northern Mali. In the south, however, and it was the south that elected him, he remains relatively popular, and people are still willing to give him a bit more of a chance before crying foul. There was a two-day strike which affected almost all public services and banks last week, which is a sign, I think, of a beginning of impatience coming from the electorate, but still popular in the south.
Okay, there are some peace talks due to restart in Algiers on Friday. Tell us about them. What are the prospects for them?
Well, yeah, these are still talks about talks. As you'll recall, apart from the Islamist Al-Qaeda occupiers that the French did their best to oust in 2013, there's an ongoing rebellion in which the Tuaregs, some of the Tuaregs and Arab populations of the north want a degree of independence. So these are the issues that are being put on the table in Algiers, having taken the initiative. Again, you know, a lot of people, international donors especially, are asking questions about why it's taken over a year since the president's election for people to get round the table, given that this is the one issue that's going to restart international investment, possibly in Mali. So, you know, very, very, very difficult to say if these talks in Algiers are going to lead anywhere. Everyone sincerely hopes they do. Quite a lot of stuff seems to be going on behind the scenes to get new people to the table. And these are only talks about talks. They will result in a roadmap and a timetable, we hope.
Okay, and for our final story, we go back to the Air Algérie plane crash, Flight 5017, which crashed in Mali back in July. What is the latest on the investigation?
Well, I mean, I just thought it would be helpful to bring us up to date on it. There's not very much new. The plane went down in a heavy thunderstorm on the 24th of July, killing all 116 people aboard. And when it came down in northeastern Mali, it came down, it would appear, directly hitting the ground and disintegrating into many, many small parts, leaving the forensic investigators with a horrendous job identifying because there weren't any bodies. bodies, basically, to put it bluntly. And so that's going on. There were two black boxes. There are always two black boxes, one a technical recorder and a second flight voice recorder. The flight voice recorder has proved unusable because, believe it or not, this McDonnell Douglas was carrying a tape recorder. And
it was an old plane. It was an old plane.
And so no voice available, but technical elements, which will be released, more of which will be released in mid-September, we believe.
Okay, Alex Duval-Smith, thank you very much for talking to us from Mali and Bamako there. Now, let's go to a little bit of music, shall we? She starts her tour tomorrow at the Hammersmith Apollo. She is Kate Bush. This is Running Up That Hill. Starting her tour tomorrow at London's Hammersmith Apollo. That's Kate Bush. And Running Up That Hill, of course. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And time now for our daily review. Today we head to Italy, where Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of the Corriere della Sera, joins us now on the line from Milan. And ciao, Luca. Is it a warm and sunny Milan, or are you suffering some of the rain we're seeing here in London?
I mean, it's really English weather, but it's the summer style of this year. So I will fly to New York the beginning of September, and I hope something better. But it's good for reading thriller, I think, this summer.
Indeed, yeah. I know you've had a terrible July. August has been slightly better. But let's talk about the arts across the country at the moment. Let's start in Milan, shall we? And Takashi Murakami has an exhibition already open.
Yeah, and it's full of color, of course, and it's in the space of Palazzo Reale, close to the Dome, and it's going on a personal exhibition of some new works of Takashi Murakami. The title is Our Art Cycle. It's curated by Francesco Bonami, and I like it because you can see until September, and it's a new wave of the work of Murakami. Is one of the maybe most eccentric contemporary artists, because the works are paintings and sculptures full of monsters, ambiguous, full colored, because we are speaking about this kind of artists. But there's something different. I mean, the works were made after the tragedy of Fukushima. And in a certain way, the artists say that it's a sort of change of his theory. The first theory, the famous theory of Takashi Murakami, was the super flat culture, a culture in which there's no distinctions between high culture, low culture. But now there's something deeper. In fact, some critics say that a super deep new way of making art for Murakami, because there's something religious, and the protagonists are the monster who came from Buddhism, because Arat are a sort of assistant of Buddha that help people in sickness for feeling better. But they are a sort of postmodern Arat, similar to the pocket monster, the Pokemon. And they look like mutants, and they came from historical Japanese and Eastern traditional monster, but there's something that he wants to show, that with Fukushima, the psychological collapse of the people, of course, the young people, more afraid than the past generation, young generation, and in a certain way, he used these archetype from Buddhism, but with a little bit of cuteness, with the wings, eyeballs, and that kind of stuff. Very unnatural, but friendly for the children. And so when we swim in this color, and of course monster figures, we feel ourselves like ancient babies between afraid and hope. And I think it's a nice exhibition, and I appreciate it.
Well, I've looked at some of the images online. Certainly is retaining a lot of the colour famous for Murakami, but as you say, with a different look on actually the subject. But let's move on, shall we, to Padova, and that Paolo Veronese This opens on the 7th of September, I believe.
Yeah, I didn't see it at the moment, but I mean, I studied and I know this is, I mean, this is another, it's famous Paolo Veronese. We are in the Renaissance moment close to Venice, and the name was Paolo Cagliari, but known as Veronese because he was born in Verona. And with Tiziano and Tintoretto was one of the great trio that dominated the Venetian paintings of the Cinquecento. And he was a supreme colorist. In fact, influenced Rubens, Watteau, Tiepolo, Delacroix, Renoir, of course, in a different way of Murakami. And the place is Musei Civici agli Eremitani in Padova, and there are a lot of works rescued from thieves and other came from other Italian and foreign museums. So if you love Italian Renaissance, especially the Venice one, it's a nice appointment. I hope and I'm sure, I'm quite sure, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, and very quickly, Luca, will you be going to the Hans Memling exhibition in Rome?
Yeah, in Rome, Scudetto Quirinale, it's a sort of coming back because an ideal, but certainly coming back because Hans Memling is a Flemish painter, maybe one of the most important of the second generation after Van Eyck or Van der Weyden. It's the first big monographic event in Italy, and it's another classic. If you are in Rome and you want to see something different from the swimming August celebration, I think you don't have to miss it.
Good idea. Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of the newspaper Corriere della Sera, thank you very much for joining us. And that is all we have time for on Midori House. Unfortunately, today's show is produced by Isabel Kayser, researched by Gaia Lutz and Erin Duffy, our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Next after the headlines is The Culture with Rob Bound. Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller are here at 2200 hours London time with a Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, from me, Ted Kravitz, it's goodbye. And thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.